The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
This is Anthony Anarino, author of The Lost Art of Closing, Winning the 10 Commitments That Drive Sales, and you are listening to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast, helping you keep up with the smartest thinking in the quickly changing field of modern marketing. And now, here's your host, Douglas Burdett.
Hello, thanks for joining me on the Marketing Book Podcast, which was named by LinkedIn as one of 10 podcasts that will make you a better marketer. My goal for this podcast is to help you discover new ideas about what's actually working in modern marketing and sales. Don't worry about taking notes. You can find links to everything linkable in this episode's show notes at marketingbookpodcast.com, which is also where you can sign up for the Marketing Book Podcast newsletter so you never miss an episode. This episode of the Marketing Book Podcast is sponsored by Content Marketing World 2017, this September. I'm going to be there. How about you? Content Marketing World is the one event where you can learn and network with the best and brightest in the content marketing industry, including several authors who have been guests on the Marketing Book Podcast. You will leave the conference with all the materials you need to take a content marketing strategy back to your team and to implement a content marketing plan that will grow your business. To register and get the best price, do two things. First, go to marketingbookpodcast.com and click on the Content Marketing World banner. Make sure to go through marketingbookpodcast.com so they'll know I sent you. Seriously, there's a bottle of scotch in it for me for everyone who registers through marketingbookpodcast.com. Then, for the lowest price, when you register, make sure to use promo code MARKETINGBOOK and they'll knock $100 off your ticket price. $100. Think about it. That's $100 you can spend buying both of us drinks once you get there and still have money left over. I'll have more details after the interview. Today, we welcome Anthony Anarino back to the Marketing Book Podcast to talk about his new book, The Lost Art of Closing, Winning the 10 Commitments That Drive Sales, published by Portfolio. Anthony Anarino is an international keynote speaker and workshop facilitator, sales leader, and sought-after sales coach. He blogs daily at thesalesblog.com, and he is the author of The Only Sales Guide You'll Ever Need. He speaks to sales organizations nationwide and teaches part-time at Capital University's School of Management and Leadership in Columbus, Ohio, where he is also an alumnus, having earned an undergraduate degree in English and later a law degree. And interesting fact, he was once the lead singer for a hair metal band in LA, and his brother is a stand-up comedian. Anthony, congratulations on The Lost Art of Closing, and welcome back to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Thanks for having me back.
So you were on before, and we talked about The Only Sales Guide You'll Ever Need, and then I was invited to the Outbound Conference in Atlanta, which is the first one you guys have ever had, and it was you and the other three horsemen of the sales apocalypse, Mark Hunter, Jeb Blunt, and Mike Weinberg, all of whom I've had the honor of interviewing. And so for me, I couldn't believe you guys got it all into one day, but it was just amazing. And each one of you must have done two keynotes, and your brother, the comedian, opened for it.
It was, what was so exceptional about that to me was that we all speak to companies, and it's always one company that we're speaking to. And so many people don't work for companies that do that. They're smaller companies. They don't spend the kind of money on a kickoff meeting or any event like that. That we did it at this amazing price point, trying to see if people would want to come out and do it. And literally half of the 400 people that showed up flew in from as far away as San Francisco to Atlanta, and they flew in from Canada and all over the place to see that show. So we were just thrilled with the result that we got and the impact that we had. There were days and days on LinkedIn where it was outbound all the time, and we were constantly being mentioned and people sharing their notes. So it was amazing, and I can't wait to do the next one. Hope you'll be there for that too.
Oh, thanks. The next one's in Dallas, I think?
The next one's Dallas. We were shooting for October, but we've had a tough time finding a venue for 500 people in the week that all of us are available. But we have one last shot on this. We had a venue, but we lost it because it was a performing arts center, and they have to prefer local artists in the community, and we got bumped. So we're still working on it.
Okay, good. Well, yeah, I'll follow that closely. It sounds like the numbers are going up, and being there, the vibe was really very positive. And of course, I was excited because I may be the only person that's ever been to the inbound and the outbound conferences. So I swing both ways, Anthony. You know, what can I say?
No one's judging you.
Thank you. Thank you. This is a safe space. So the book, The Lost Art of Closing, the foreword is by Brent Adamson and Nick Toman. Brent Adamson, at least, was one of the authors of Challenger Sale, and Nick Toman and Brent both were authors on the Challenger Customer. So I was just... Talk about, you know, getting an opening act like those two. Those are two of my favorite books. And I enjoyed reading this. I am going to have to ask you for another pen because I just used up so much ink marking this thing up just for my own personal business purposes, not for the purpose of this interview. But I'm a little confused, though, Anthony, because when you were last on the podcast, as I mentioned, I interviewed you about the only sales guide you'll ever need. So I kind of figured Anthony Annarino is going to be the preeminent one-hit wonder of the sales book world.
Yeah.
But now you're back with another book. What's going on here, Annarino?
It's confusing, isn't it? You know, well, here's the true story. The book's name originally, the first book was 17 Elements, and it was based on the periodic table. It was a periodic table of sales success. And the publisher could not have hated that name anymore. I mean, from the very first interaction they had with me, and I told them the name of the book. They're like, that's a terrible name. And I said, well, hang on. I want to be clear on how you feel about this. So I don't want you to have to, you know, mince your words here. And they said, the book needs to answer the question in the buyer's mind. And I said, so you mean like the Challenger sale? And like, well, that's not a really good example. And I'm like, it's the best example. They sold 300,000 copies of the book. I mean, there can't be a better example. And we went back and forth on this, but the fact of the matter is they will not tell you that they're reserving the right to name the book. It's not in the contract that they get to name it, but they'll tell you that you can collaborate with them, and then ultimately they name the book. So that's the way the book business works. You don't name your book. The reason they named it The Only Sales Guide You'll Ever Need is because it's a competency model, and it's got skill sets and mindsets together. And what they thought it was it's a very complete competency model, like one that hasn't been written before, which is why they called it The Only Sales Guide You'll Ever Need. And the truth is, when you go out to The Lost Art of Closing and you watch the launch video that just went up, if you hear this podcast, I will confess, we had a two-book deal right from beginning, and we agreed on this book before the first book was even published. So we knew we were writing this book at that time because I knew that the content was critical for helping people get a greater level of success. So it was not the only sales guide you'll ever need, and nor did anyone believe that when we did it. It was just a provocative title, and they liked it.
Well, and I'm glad it means that you won't be stopping writing these books. And that video, I've seen it, and if we can, we'll share it on your show notes. But it included some very funny bits from Mark Hunter and Mike Weinberg, some of your brothers from Another Mother.
Yeah, I got a lot of people in the act. And you also got Brent and Nick in there.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Sorry.
And you got Will Weiser from Portfolio, my publisher.
Right. And Gerhard, whose last name I can never pronounce.
Schwantner.
Okay.
With the traditional spelling with a G at the front.
Right. Those Austrians. Okay, I just want to read two excerpts, and then I promise I won't read any more. But just to set the stage for some of the things I want to talk to you about. And it's actually an excerpt from toward the very end of the book, page 210. And it says, the skills of sales have gone through three major periods. As soon as people started trading, they needed to know how to prospect, present, and close. These are first generation skills, and they are still completely necessary. As we moved into the industrial age, new skills were acquired, like differentiating your offering, diagnosing your clients' needs, and negotiating. These second generation skills are also still necessary, but insufficient by themselves. In this third generation, post-industrial age, new skills are required. These include business acumen, change management, and leadership, because in large, complex business-to-business sales, it's not enough to offer a client a good product or service and then walk away. Many times you are asking that they change their way of doing something, and change is always difficult. It's difficult to embrace the idea of change. It's difficult to agree to change. It's difficult to begin initiating and then to adapt to that change. And it can be difficult to sustain that change. And then I just want to read one other short part from page 153, and then we're going to get into the book, from the section on deciding. You said, there was a time when securing this agreement, otherwise known as closing the deal, was believed to be the most important and challenging part of selling. Every salesperson worth his salt had a copy of Zig Ziglar's Secrets of Closing the Sale and Tom Hopkins' How to Master the Art of Selling, both of which subscribe to this idea. But today, we live in a different time that calls for a different approach. So, Anthony, is closing really a lost art? And if so, why?
It's a lost art for a couple reasons, and I'll try to set you up with just a little bit of history. When you think about what was necessary to sell, and when you just think about the Industrial Revolution, your grandparents had an ice box on their back porch, and the iceman would come and bring ice, and they would store things in an ice box outside of their home. And then at some point, we're mass producing refrigerators because we're in the industrial age now and mass production is all the rage. And I don't think I need a refrigerator because I've lived my whole life without a refrigerator and I've never known anyone who had a refrigerator. And my ancestors survived and brought me to this point without having a refrigerator. And somebody has to go and make markets. So a lot of the sales tactics that were developed through that period of time were more aggressive and more of a hard close because you were literally making markets. There was never a need for this thing, and you have to force this onto people who don't believe they need it. And because of where we were in the evolution of human consciousness and culturally, that was the skill set that existed to get people to buy. And we weren't more sophisticated in the realm of selling than what they were doing then, but they were doing what was necessary. So we just developed these hard sale tactics and techniques to make markets and to sell things that people before didn't know that they needed. So these were the right skill sets to train people on. And on the video on the Lost Art launch, I do a hard sell where you can hear me pretend to sell somebody insurance. And it was really full of tie downs and pressure and making somebody do something that they don't want to do. And selling was literally at that time something you were doing to someone. You were selling them. And what happened as we matured and as markets got more crowded and as some of the power shifted from sellers to buyers to consumers, people started to recognize, you know what? I don't have to buy from Doug. Doug is pushy. Doug is self-oriented. He makes me feel bad every time I'm in a room with him. I can buy from somebody else who makes me actually feel good about this and who's going to treat me in a different way. And so over time, those hard sell techniques started to work against people and the pendulum swung. But as a pendulum does, it often goes all the way to the other side before it comes back the other direction. And what happened is we went from always be closing to never be closing. Don't ask anybody to commit to anything. Look, when they're ready, they're going to signal you that they're ready and they have the power in the relationship now and you need to follow their lead and your job is just there to serve them. And that is equally as unhealthy as the hard sell, always be closing, you know, push hard, there's three copies here, the final copy is yours. That's equally as bad because I'm also, when I go that far to that extreme, I'm also not serving the client either. They need help changing and they need someone to help initiate that change. And it means that they have to make a series of commitments that they keep in order to change their organization. And this book has not been written in this form by anyone else, but I think it's the right thing for right now. Because when we go and we try to help people, and you used the quote there that I dedicated the book to, instigators, agitators, catalysts, and change agents, this is how you help people change. First, you get a commitment for time, and then you get a commitment to explore, and then you get a commitment to decide that it makes sense to change and do something different. And then you collaborate, and then you build consensus, and then you discuss investments. And there's 10 commitments at least that you have to walk somebody through to actually take them from the current status quo to a better future state. And that's what closing means today. It's not about that final ask. And in fact, if you talk to B2B sales professionals who are succeeding, they'll tell you that's the easy one. The final ask is the easy one. If you've done everything right up to that point, that it just makes sense to move forward after we've done this work. It's the ones that come before it that cause us all the problems now, and it's never been addressed. And when I wrote The Only Sales Guide, I knew it had never been addressed, and I previewed it in that book. But I had been developing the content for this because I recognize the main thing that you need to do is control this process and help the buyer know what they need to do to actually get the results that they want.
And just to go back to your other book, at the end of every chapter, you had recommended reading, which, you know, for a sales and marketing book nerd like me was like giving me more crack. But at the end of the chapter on closing in that book, you said, I don't have any books to recommend here. Most everything that has been written is out of date and offers tactics that will actually make you less effective and cost you deals. Boy, yeah. If that wasn't a preview for the next book, I don't know what was. So,
well, you didn't know it then, but you know now.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So,
and since then, though, James Muir has written a book, The Perfect Close, which I would recommend.
Oh, okay. Yeah, you know, Jeb Blunt recommended that as well.
Yeah, I would recommend that one. That one is in line with this thinking. It doesn't cover the same territory as The Lost Art of Closing, but it is in line with the principles.
Well, James, I'm pretty sure, is a listener. So props to James out there. Hello. And what I wanted to do, though, go back in time just a bit. Your last name is Anarino.
That's right.
The logo for your podcast in the arena is the Roman Forum. No,
Colosseum.
Colosseum, yeah. So I want to speak a little Latin with you. I know you have a law degree, so you're probably familiar with a lot of these Latin terms. But can you explain this concept of how we've gone from caveat emptor to caveat venditor?
Yeah, that's a really, really interesting change. That if you notice what's happened, for a long time, it was buyer beware. And it was your responsibility not to get bamboozled or hoodwinked by some salesperson. And that didn't work very well for people who were taken advantage of. And literally, there are laws still on the books that you can rescind a contract within 3 days of signing it. If you felt like you were under any pressure, you can rescind the contract. And those laws were put in place specifically because salespeople behaved badly and pressured people, and they signed under the duress of being pressured by a salesperson, and then later on felt like, you know what, I'm not going to let that person do this to me. And so there were lawsuits, and then eventually laws were passed to stop people from taking advantage of other people. In fact, when I buy cars, I still have to sign something saying that the salesperson did not abuse me in any way. Now, he doesn't have to sign anything that says I didn't abuse him in any way, which would probably be a good idea. I bought a lot of cars. But the caveat venditor means seller beware. And if you behave badly now, I've got Yelp, I've got Google reviews, I've got my own blog, I've got my Facebook page. I have a whole bunch of ways, including if I'm on an airplane and I'm watching somebody abused, taking a video of that and putting it on Facebook and sharing it with the world to say, this is how this person treats other people. Mm-hmm. And so the shoe is now solidly on the other foot. And there's a lot of power in the buyer side of the equation here, which I would say that it's not out of balance. I think some people think the buyer has all the power, but they don't. But there's certainly some more power that's shifted in their direction. And it means you need to sell in a way that serves you longer term, which means you don't behave with short-term tactics when you're trying to develop lifetime relationships and you're trying to build a reputation as a trusted advisor and as a consultative person who can help people produce better results.
Now, Anthony, the last time you were on, we talked about this one particular chapter, which now is a whole book. And, you know, you call it a Freudian slip or whatever, but in the interview, I said, hey, let's talk about these 10 commandments of closing. And you said, no, it's the 10 commitments. I said, no, it's the commandments. And I looked it up. I mean, I can play the interview now. And I said, oh, you're right, it is commitments. And you said, you know, I don't want to get all religious on you here, but you clearly need some therapy. But that's the basis of the book. And I want to talk about a few of them because we don't have time to go
through
all.
But before we leave there, though, I still think the therapy thing could be a good idea.
Oh, there's no question. As a matter of fact, the building, the office building I'm in, I think there's 12 different therapists in this building. There's just several psychiatric practices.
And all it's not coincidental that you're there.
All I can think is, like, you know, if you see a big manufacturing plant, there's other suppliers that sprout up nearby. They clearly want to be where the business is or will be. So, yeah.
I think it was nice of them to let you out to come to the Outbound conference.
Yes, thanks. Well, and yeah, it was good. I did have to get permission for them. But anyway, enough about me. So you talk about these 10 different commitments. So you talk about you control the commitments, you control the process. And as a marketer, I've got to say that closing for me is a lot like search engine optimization in this way. In the past, you know, 10 years ago or whatever, you could build a website and then you could go hire an SEO firm and just say, okay, now just kind of do some tinkering with the site and that'll get it found in some better search engine results. And of course, you can't fool Google or the search engines now. And now, instead of something that happens at the very end, it has to be baked in. The SEO has to be baked in from the very beginning. So it's like SEO has gone from the icing on the cake to the eggs that go in the cake. And that, I couldn't help but notice how similar that was to what you talk about in terms of the closing. It really starts at the very beginning. And you've got these 10 different commitments, same ones from the book, but much more detailed. And before we start talking about that, I just wanted to mention that one of the things from one of your keynotes at the Outbound conference is this concept where you said, you know, you can't be going to companies and just asking them what their problems are. You've got to come to them and say, this is what you should be worrying about. So in other words, what are you worried about? No. You've got to now come to them and say, this is what you should be worrying about. Can we jump into that one?
That's in the chapter on the commitment for time, and it's a thread through the book. But this is the thing, and you heard me say this at Outbound, you only need two things to be a trusted advisor. It's a very simple recipe with two ingredients, trust and advice. And if you don't have the advice, then you're missing what you need to have the recipe to be a trusted advisor. And the way that you need to think about this, if there's information parity and your client already knows everything that they know and they already know everything that you know, you don't have any value to be created. Mm-hmm. So you can't counsel them and you can't give them advice that you don't have. For many, many years, we walked in and said, what's keeping you up at night, which the Challenger guys dispelled.
And you said that is the worst possible question to ask.
The reason is that everyone has done it. So it's another salesperson sitting in front of me trying to get me to disclose what I'm dissatisfied about. And it's not interesting and it's not provocative enough for me to change the behavior. And I know people still want to do that. We still want to find the dissatisfaction, but there's other ways to have that conversation. Mm-hmm. As a trusted advisor, as somebody who wants to be counsel for other people and think about how they help them produce better results, you need to have an opinion about what's going on in their world. And you need an opinion that's backed up by facts and experience so that you can say, these are the things that people in your role are concerned with, and these are the areas where they're asking different questions right now because the next 12 to 18 months looks different than the last 12 to 18 months. And so new decisions are going to have to be made. And when you have the ability to say, let me walk you through some of the things that we're seeing, and let me share with you some of the questions that we're helping people answer, and let me get your feedback on what you think about this, you're entering into the conversation at a different point, which says, I have ideas that you don't yet have. I have an understanding of this that you may not yet have considered. I have experience working with other people who have moved past some of these challenges, so I have some situational knowledge that might be a benefit to you. And that's positioning you in a very, very different spot as a change agent than somebody who walks in and says, you tell me what's going on in your world, and then I'll respond to it with my products.
Right. I'm laughing to keep from crying. But that concept that you talk about, it for me, it brought to mind, the again, back to the Challenger customer, where this expression they had throughout their book, it was the customer has to understand that the pain of same is worse than the pain of change. And we can get on to that in just a second. But as it related to this, the second point, which was the commitment to explore, there was one thing that jumped out of the book at me that had big implications for marketers. And that's where, as it relates to this, you say, you know, when you're going forward to these prospects, you say, unless you have an enlightened marketing department that will provide you with this type of content, you're going to have to do your homework. And that begins with considering issues such as, and I'll just mention the three bullet points, not the whole ones, but the first one was, what are the primary challenges your dream clients, your ideal clients face that your solution would solve for them? And another one was, what are the root causes of each of those problems? And the last one you mentioned was, what are the economic, technological, cultural, political, or scientific trends that are causing the problem or challenge or creating an opportunity? And that just seemed like a big opportunity to fuel a lot of the content that marketers could be helping the salespeople with.
You saw me speak, and you saw me talk about the four levels of value creation.
Yes.
And if I were to walk into a sales organization and take all their marketing collateral and lay it across a big table, what you would see is a lot of level one product marketing material. So that's features and benefits, and let me tell you about what we do. And you'd see some level two, which is, this is the experience. Here's people who said they had a good experience. Here's what we've done, maybe even some case studies. And then you'd see a few things in the level three pile that is ROI. Those would be case studies and white papers and things like that to prove that we can actually generate these results. But at the very end of the table, there might be one or two sheets of paper that somebody found that they can make a case is about strategic thinking around where should the client be moving right now. And that would be the smallest stack of papers and content, and it would be the most necessary for the sales people to have in their possession to guide conversations with clients. So we've got the marketing stack completely backwards, where we have way too much about what we do and who we are and why you should buy from us, and too little on why you should change at all. And that's the direction that marketing needs to move now to serve the sales force. You need to move into the area to say, this is why they should change. And it's not changing because our product can get them a better result. It's changing because we live in a world of accelerating, disruptive, constant change. And what people need is the ability to think through what are the implications. And so if you just think about customer experience, which everybody talks about now, if you don't respond to my request for help over Twitter, then you're ignoring me. And I've got this something sitting on your Twitter page that says I need help, and you've done nothing about it because you opened up that channel. The expectations on consumers have changed dramatically. If you're not messaging me on Facebook and you're not responding on Twitter, and that's the kind of change that's significantly going to reshape an industry and many industries because the customer expectation has changed. There's now tools to support it. You need to talk about changing customer expectations, not we have a technology that allows you to do this. And it's just where we enter into the conversation. Marketers, if you want to help salespeople, you have to help them enter in from the higher level, strategic, and then we can work back to product. But they're missing the content and the strong direction and the talk tracks on more strategic conversations. And that's why this is so difficult for them.
Well said. And I also would have to add it in defense of some of these marketing people, a lot of them are being screamed at saying, I need more sales sheets, I need more product. Just give me that. That's all I need. So I think that's where the marketers need to use some of their leadership to help educate their sales peers about how the content can actually be more helpful to them.
Yeah. And there are, I mean, I've spoken to companies where the marketing department is so enlightened, all they're doing is creating strategic level content because they've already had plenty of the other stuff. And when I look at what they're doing about how values-based it is and about how compelling it is, it's shocking how good it is. I mean, they get it, and they're helping people make change.
Yeah, that's terrific. That's terrific. Now, like I say, there's 10 whole sections of this. We can't get to all of them, but I did want to talk about what I thought was, for me, the most important.
Why am I wasting my time on a podcast where we're not even going to get all 10 commitments?
They got to buy the book. Work with me, Anthony.
Okay.
I'm trying to help you
gotcha.
Out, brother. And that's the commitment to change. The commitment to change. And you say that for a real sales opportunity to exist, your prospective client must agree that they have a compelling reason to change and that they want a better future state. Why is that so crucial?
Because unless they're committed to change, you're going to have some very nice conversations that don't result in anything. Mm-hmm. And I've told the story in there, and it's a true story. I was speaking, and I watched people do a review of a pipeline, and I started laughing at them while they were doing it.
This is a customer?
Yeah, much to the chagrin of the executive vice president, because I laughed out loud. There was a deal. It was 1,741 days old.
Oh, that's
right. I pulled my iPhone out so I could do the math on that because I didn't know how many years that was.
Right, right.
But it's closing in on 5 years. And they have a 180-day sales cycle on average. And I literally said, if this deal were a child, it would be starting kindergarten this year.
Right.
And just to show them, like, this is how much time has gone by since this thing was put into your CRM. And it was to make the point that they had a lot of opportunities that I could see that really weren't opportunities, because if the client had committed to change, there was no way on earth it was going to take them 5 years to do this kind of a change. It's a 180-day sales cycle. So we have these conversations. People say, that's interesting. We'd like to talk more. Well, look at this. But until somebody says, Doug, listen, we've had a number of conversations about this. Is this the right kind of change initiative for you to undertake right now? And should we be spending time here? Or is there something else that would be more valuable for you to do? Is it time for you to change now? And until somebody says that, and somebody says, yeah, we actually do need to change, and it does make sense for us to invest the time here, you don't have an opportunity. And there are pipelines full of very nice conversations that people are having right now where that commitment hasn't been made. And until somebody asks that question, and a follow-up question, Doug, what would be the best date for you to go live if we decided that this is the right thing to do and we found a way to get you this outcome? When would it make sense to do this, and when would it make sense to start? And when you say, probably in the fourth quarter and probably not until we finish this thing, and it will be most likely November sometime. Now I have a date that I can look at and say, why is that date the right date? Well, because that's the date the customer said is the right date for them to do it. And we can get honest and have some integrity, number one, in the conversations we're having with clients, but two, internally, when we start talking about deals, we can talk about real deals and not things that are still in the development stage. They're not yet quite an opportunity.
So you talked about some of the clues that let you know you're not looking at a real opportunity. You're just chasing a lead. And well, there's no compelling reason to change is one of them.
Yeah.
And you say there's no vision of the future, which I think that's up to the salesperson to try and paint for them or help them.
True.
Help reveal for the customer.
That's right.
And then you talk about the commitment process has halted. So can you talk a bit more about the commitment process as it relates to the 10 different commitments? We don't need all of them, but what you mean by these series of 10 instead of, I guess, the other extreme would be one big closing at the end, which seems to be engraved into the consciousness of a lot of salespeople.
There can be something that happens on the client side where they get acquired, and now the process comes screeching to a halt because it's a new company and this company hasn't committed to taking this path. It can halt because they have another priority, and this priority starts to take precedence over the deal that you're creating. And maybe your deal's valuable, but not quite as valuable as something else. Somebody can decide, we've just lost the head of IT and we don't want to do anything until we bring somebody in and they are involved in this process, because they're going to be the one that has to carry it forward. Anything that would stop this person from taking the next step with us means it's no longer an opportunity, and I have to move it back down into the stage where I recreate that opportunity or get another commitment. What you see in pipelines is when there's no next commitment, you can almost be positive that the commitment process has halted on their end, and you have a stalled or a stuck deal that you need to do something about. And these things don't go, they're linear in the book, because to write a book, you have to do this in this format. But you can go straight through a half a dozen commitments that work very well and then go back a few steps because a new stakeholder comes in and you don't have their consensus. And so you need to bring them in. But this is the process, and it tends to move. When deals move quickly, the commitments happen without interruption. And when they take a long time, the commitments tend to get interrupted, and we have to, you know, the linchpin attribute from The Only Sales Guide is resourcefulness. We have to figure out what to do.
Mm-hmm. So I want to just talk about money for a minute here, because that's such a big issue in sales and in life and all that. And a couple of things that just really jumped off the page at me, and this is under the section on the commitment to invest. So it's, I guess you could argue it's the budget step in some other sales training paradigms. But you say it's your job to help a prospective client see that the greater danger he faces, a danger far greater than increasing the size of his investment, is under investing. Please explain.
This is probably an enormous epidemic that's costing our economy billions and billions of dollars. And it is that people have been trained that a good deal means I got a lower price. And a good deal means I invested the right amount of money to get massively better outcomes. And it's an ROI calculation. It's not a price calculation. But because we've had two recessions in the United States, one global, purchasing has grown tremendously in power, and so have supply chain managers. And there's been a lot of pressure, you know, from big companies like a Walmart or an Amazon to push down pricing so they can pass that savings on. And they get a smaller bit of arbitrage, but they're getting it across a much greater number of transactions. And that's a business model decision. And many businesses weren't designed to do that or to offer that kind of value proposition. Some of us create greater value rather than lower price. And the challenge we have is that somebody comes along and says, I can give you better, faster, and cheaper. And to the customer, that's great. That's the trifecta, right? I'm going to get better results. They're going to be faster than we're doing things now. And it's going to cost me less. And then they're
going to win the lottery too.
Me too. The Powerball specifically. And and this doesn't come true. But it's sort of the fairy tale that clients hold on to, is that there's somebody who can do this even cheaper and be even better than we have. And it never comes true. And we don't go in and disabuse them of that and say, to get a better result, you need to invest more. And when has it ever made sense for one of your clients to pull money out of their solution to get a better result? You're pulling money out of your solution instead of putting more money into the solution. And the fact of the matter is, we've allowed clients to underinvest in the result. And we've been able to retain them because we're equally as bad as our competitors, rather than forcing them to give us a little bit more money by having a conversation about what the real outcomes are and about explaining the risk of underinvesting so we can deliver for them and get them better outcomes. And it generally means that they have to invest more in the result, not invest less in the result. And that's a huge mistake that we've made. That chapter comes late in the book. For a lot of people, if you're listening to this and the company that you work for sells a higher price product, solution, or service, I would move this way up to the front of the conversation and just start out by saying, Doug, I think this looks like an investment of $1.2 million to $1.4 million. How's that tracking with what you're thinking? I would move it up and say, our price is going to be higher than our competitors because we're going to do these things different to create even greater value. And you're going to understand that and the value of that as we go through this process. Does that make sense to you? I would want to move it up forward and show people, look, I'm going to ask you to invest more, but I'm going to give you way more then you're getting now and solve these problems for you and allow you to take advantage of all the value that we create in moving your business forward.
Mm-hmm. And you said that the greater investment you require is actually one of your competitive advantages. Can you explain that?
It is the hardest thing for salespeople to understand for some reason, that their higher price is a sword, and they think that they have to hide behind a shield. And they have to be apologetic. And I mean, if you walk onto a Mercedes lot, they never say, Doug, I'm really sorry that this is going to cost more than a Kia. I apologize for our price being higher. But that's the stance that a lot of salespeople take. And the commitment to acquire your services at a higher price is you matching the commitment with saying, we're going to create greater value. And it's a heuristic, it's a rule of thumb or a shortcut that people look at to say, things that have a higher price tend to be better than things that have a lower price. And generally, that's true. If you want to make selling easy, you think if my price is lower and I'm better, then I should be able to win every time. Yeah, but that's not true. Your price is lower and you're not better, or you're better and your price is higher. That's the way things work. But when your client's looking at you, when you explain we have a higher price because we create greater results, then people are interested in knowing how and why and what you can do for them that makes it worth investing. We're at this swing, though, where the pendulum has come back the other way. We've cut so much. I listened in on a call with a group of salespeople who were being invited to respond to an RFP, and an enlightened supply chain manager said, I need to know how you can help us control our costs without reducing your pricing, because we need you to be strategic and we need you to be able to invest in this relationship. And we have to find ways to do that outside of you reducing your price. And that's because we've gone so far the other way. Everybody's cut everything out of the business and now we don't get the results we want, and it's swinging back the other direction.
Well, before we wrap up, I'd like to ask you just two other questions about the book. Can you explain why you think that the fear of deciding is at an epidemic proportion right now.
There's a number of reasons. One, I think that people are under greater pressure to perform, and the status quo is the devil that I know, and change is the devil that I don't know. So I don't know what to anticipate. Also, I'm going to have a bunch of stakeholders when it doesn't work out who are going to point to me as the cause for making this change inside my own company. And I'm going to get a lot of flack and a lot of pushback for taking people down a path when it doesn't work. People have had enough experience making change to know that things don't tend to work the way that they're supposed to very quickly. And they worry about these kind of things. When I started selling and I got good at it, I used to just tell clients in the proposal meeting, we're going to do all of these things for you, and it's going to take us 3 to 4 tries to be able to get it right. And somebody, normally somebody really mature, would say something like, 3 to 4 tries? You guys are good. It would take us 8 tries. And it's just that acknowledgement that this is going to be something that's going to take time, and here's where we're going to go off the tracks, and here's what we're going to have to do when this happens, that gave people the trust, like, wait a second, this is for real. We're going to actually go through this process that helps people. But the decision to decide, once you've done that, you cut yourself off from the status quo, and now you're in, and it's scary for people. And they would rather live with the devil they know than the devil they don't know. And the chapter that the publisher wanted to cut out of the book was fearing the wrong danger and transformational conversations. And I insisted on leaving it in because that's when we're at our very best. That's what we're doing. We're helping people change, and we're helping them deal with that fear about change. And until they deal with that and decide to move forward, they're going to continue to get the results they're getting right now.
Yeah, and you talked about how resistance to change is a form of self-preservation, probably going back to the caveman.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm going to lose my job. I'm going to lose my significance. I'm going to have people coming after me.
Yeah.
Thank you for your time.
Let us think it over. Yeah.
Exactly.
Right. So one other thing, and this kind of ties it back to your first book. Can you explain what you mean when you say that who you are matters far more than what you do?
If there's any theme that runs through everything that I do on the blog, on the YouTube channel, and now in 2 books, who you are, if you want to be a trusted advisor, if you want to be consultative, if you want to be the kind of person that people want to do business with, those tend to be character issues. Those tend to be mindset and skill set issues. And it doesn't tend to be what you sell or things like that. It doesn't tend to be the things that we look at as surface things. It's really interesting. I was with CEB and a group of influencers last week, and we had a lot of conversation about AI and about automation and all kinds of other things. So I don't think that salespeople are going to be disintermediated and automated. I think we're going to be augmented. I think we're going to leverage data, and we're going to leverage technology to be even more of a trusted advisor with even greater insights. But at the end of that section, I pointed back to the John Boyd quote that he used to, beat the Defense Department with all the time, which was people, ideas, technology, in that order. And for some reason right now, because we have so much technology and we're at the beginning of the information age, and who's if that'll even be what it's called when it's done. But we've got it technology, ideas, people. We've got it exactly backwards. But who you are, what you bring to the table, are you the kind of person that I want to do business with? Are you the kind of person that I want on my team? Are you thoughtful, and do you have ideas and the ability to help me make change inside my own organization? Can you help me figure out how to mitigate the damage that we're doing in this department when we do this thing so that they don't get hurt? These are the things. This is who you are at your core. Can you actually help people go through change, and can you be there for them? Do you know how to be that kind of a partner? That matters more than anything else. And if you get anything right from these 2 books, and it's deciding that I'm going to be the person that can do this for and with my clients, that's a competitive advantage above anything else, whether it's product or pricing or anything else that somebody can bring to bear on a deal. And I think that's going to be true for a long time.
Yes, your book is probably going to be selling for a very long time. The only sales guide you'll ever need, what you've just explained is why, as I was reading it last year, that quote from Marine Corps General James Mattis, who's currently the U.S. Secretary of Defense, he said, the most important 6 inches on the battlefield is the space between your ears. That quote kept going through my head as I was reading The Only Sales Guide You'll Ever Need. So that's why it's going to be around for a long time.
And of course, you have to now go to his legendary answer when he was asked, what keeps you up at night? Which was, nothing. I keep other people up at night. And that's because what's between his ears is dangerous.
Yes, yes. And I also think he's going to replace Chuck Norris memes. He seems to be the next guy now that I see all over Facebook. So you kind of answered it, but if readers took only one thing away from this book, The Lost Art of Closing, what would you hope it would be?
If you want to really help people change, you have to control the process and help them make the commitments that they need to get what they really want. And that's, you have to be somebody that's big enough and good enough to do that. That's really the heart of this book.
That's right. You said control the commitments, control the process. And I also think that's why that's a further affirmation that salespeople will never go away. Anthony, what books have inspired your work and career? I know one of them you mentioned in your book was Neil Rackham's Spin Selling.
Spin Selling, I mean, was, if there's any root that gave rise to this book, it's Neil Rackham's Spin Selling. And it's not the spin model. It was the fact that some salespeople got a commitment that moved deals forward and some got a continuation. And that's really all Rackham said about it when he wrote that book in 1988, or published in 1988 anyway. And this is the fleshing out of me taking what Rackham said and putting it to work in businesses and generating hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars by just following that directive of get an advance, not a continuation, and then just keeping track of what those advances tended to be. That's what this book is. So that book, very, very influential. I tend to read outside of sales predominantly to find ideas that I can bring into sales now. So I read an American philosopher named Ken Wilber, who's probably my favorite person to read right now. I'm reading a book called Scale by Jeffrey West. And it is about how our linear thinking about scale is not in line with what science teaches us and how to think about scaling organizations and human societies and cities. So I tend to read things outside of our domain for the most part.
As you should. And that's why marketers should read, other than marketing books, they should be reading literature and history, and they should be reading sales books. Because if you are in a group of marketers and you read more sales books than the others, you're going to be a more valuable marketer. By the way, if you're a marketer that's never been on a sales call, go on one.
Or 100.
Yeah. You'll be 100 times better a marketer if you go on a sales call. So, Anthony, how best can listeners learn more about you and your new book?
The best place to go is thesalesblog.com or youtube.com/AnnArino. And right now, for the book, you go to thelostartofclosing.com, and there'll be a whole bunch of bonuses and stuff like that up.
Great. I just want to read one last excerpt. Indulge me here. From page 212. The commitments you studied in this book are those required to help your dream clients change and produce better outcomes. The very best salespeople today, those who will continue to be in demand in the future, are those who know how to create a compelling case for change and lead their clients through that process. This is going to matter more and more as we move into a future of accelerating disruptive change. The name of the book is The Lost Art of Closing, Winning the 10 Commitments That Drive Sales. The author is Anthony Annarino. Anthony, thank you very much for being on the Marketing Book Podcast.
Thanks for having me, Doug.
And that closes the book on episode 135 of the Marketing Book Podcast. Links to everything linkable in the interview you just listened to are at marketingbookpodcast.com. And that's also where you can sign up for the Marketing Book Podcast newsletter so you never miss an episode. And to register for Content Marketing World, just go to marketingbookpodcast.com, click on the Content Marketing World banner so they'll know I sent you. And then, for the very best price, enter promo code MarketingBook. And if you have any feedback on the show, I would love to hear from you. Just go to marketingbookpodcast.com and leave me a message or tweet at me. My Twitter handle is MarketingBook. Or connect with me on LinkedIn. My name again is Douglas Burdett. And please join us next time as we welcome David Meerman Scott back to the show to talk about the new 6th edition of his best-selling book, The New Rules of Marketing and PR, How to Use Social Media, Online Video, Mobile Applications, Blogs, News Releases, and Viral Marketing to Reach Buyers Directly. Thanks again for listening to the Marketing Book Podcast. I'm on to you. I noticed at the end of each chapter, you gained a commitment to read the next chapter. I saw what you were doing there.
I just thought it would be playful to do that.
Yeah.
I thought it would be playful to just put a commitment at the end of every chapter.